In this part of the show, we will continue talking about American political history as we talk with the author of a newly published book that looks at the history of the Republican Party. And as I mentioned back at the beginning, there are two new books that have just been published. They're both out from Random House, and they're intended to be companions to one another. The one that we talked about in the first hour of the show about the Democrats, and this book about the Republicans, it's titled Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans, and the author is our guest, Lewis Gould. He is the Eugene C. Barker Centennial Professor Emeritus in American History at University of Texas at Austin, has won awards for both outstanding teaching and writing. He's the author of many books of political history. He makes his home in Austin, Texas, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, as always, questions are welcome. We just ask people, please, to be brief in their comments and questions so we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But if you'd like to call, that's certainly great. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And we also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Professor Gould, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I want to start with a couple of points, and really they're the same things that we talked about at the beginning of last hour's show as we were talking about the Democrats. And it is the fact that, and it is true of both the parties, the Republicans and Democrats, that both parties, if you look at what they stood for when they were first organized and what they stand for now, have changed very significantly. And in the case of the Republicans, what began as a party that believed in government activism and things like high tariffs, a party that championed the rights of African Americans, now is a party that is opposed to big government. They're opposed to high taxes. They have opposed affirmative action. They are no longer the party of African Americans. So here, and the same thing happened with the Democrats, it's as if the two parties switched positions. And in fact, that's largely what they did.
Yes, if you looked at the what it meant to be a Democrat in 1854 when the Republicans were founded and what it means to be a Democrat today or what it means to be a Republican then and a Republican now, there are continuities, but there are, as you point out, significant differences.
And again, I think the same thing is true if you ask, well, why did this happen? That indeed, one thing that hasn't changed, with the exception of the moving of substantial numbers of African Americans from the Republicans to Democrats, is that the core, the base of the parties really haven't changed. And the reason the parties changed their positions on some of these important issues was because their base, their core, changed. And so the parties had to change to reflect the concerns of their constituencies.
Yeah, that's basically correct, that as the different electoral bases of support in the United States shifted. I mean, when the Democrats were the party of the solid South, they were the party of states' rights and white supremacy and small government. When the Republicans were the party of activism and nationalism in the North and Middle West and had difficulty penetrating the South, they took a different position. But also, of course, there was one sea change in the early 20th century when we went from an economy where the issue was how best to promote the growth of the economy, and Republicans and Democrats differed on that, to how best to regulate, if at all, an industrial society. That caused a shifting of philosophy between the Republicans and the Democrats that we're still living with today.
Yeah, that's where the Republicans really, that was at the point when they were looking at the legitimate role for a big central government, particularly in doing things like building infrastructure, and that at a certain point, once that kind of thing was accomplished, then the Republicans did seem to have much more of a hands-off approach, a deregulatory kind of approach, an approach that says, okay, now the government has done its job, now it should stop, and essentially, particularly when it came to the economy, kind of substantially get out of it.
Yes, that around 1912 or in the first two decades of the 20th century, that issue came to the front, largely pushed by Theodore Roosevelt among Republicans. And in 1912, when they rejected Roosevelt as their nominee and stayed with President William Howard Taft, from that point onward, they adopted a more conservative position. And the Democrats under Woodrow Wilson and FDR, as you no doubt talked about in a preceding hour, moved toward what might be loosely called a more liberal position, as we now define it.
there also, you have to be careful, I guess, of making sweeping generalizations, but generally speaking, the Republicans have always been the party of business. Is that right?
Well, the party, as they would conceive it, of entrepreneurial Americans, or the Americans who want to make their way in the economy, and seeing Americans more as a conglomeration of producers. Hmm. And the Democrats usually see Americans as a combination of consumers. Now, that's oversimplified. They're obviously entrepreneurial Democrats, but even in their 19th century incarnation, the Democrats tended to see individuals working autonomously by themselves for the better good of the country, while Republicans believed and still believe in the notion that there's a sort of interdependence of the whole society, and that if you help one section, the benefits diffuse themselves throughout society. And so that's where the Republicans, when they talk about their suspicion of class warfare, they don't see there being different interests of different groups in society. Essentially, they all have a common interest, and so that if you provide a government provides a setting in which those talents can be realized and encourage those talents to be realized, then a better society will ensue. This goes back to some of the antecedents in the Whig Party of the mid-19th century. Many Republicans were former Whigs like Abraham Lincoln, and they kept that ideology alive within the Republican Party.
The Republican Party is the younger of the two. Next year, celebrating its 150th anniversary. And certainly, if there's one issue that has been associated with the party and was perhaps its reason for being, is slavery. It's the party of Abraham Lincoln, although he was not the first. He was actually the second Republican to run for president. He was the one who won. John Fremont ran before Lincoln and didn't win. But so it's in what way does slavery and the argument over slavery help to create the Republican Party?
Well, it's of the essence in creating the Republican Party, because one of your great Illinois senators, Stephen A. Douglas, a Democrat in 1854, sought to organize the territories or the areas that are now Kansas and Nebraska in the bill called, appropriately enough, the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And in it, he left the issue of whether there would be slavery in these new territories up to the people of the territories in what he called popular sovereignty. Well, this raised suddenly the issue of whether slavery could expand into the western territories, which many people in the North thought had been settled forever by the Missouri Compromise in 1820. So suddenly, for many Northerners, this issue of slavery expansion was a hot-button issue, and now it was, to mix the metaphor, on the front burner at the same time. And in the protests against the Kansas-Nebraska Act, with the decline of the Whig Party, people started saying, well, we need another separate party to oppose slavery expansion, to speak for our economic interests, and to articulate our values. And they took the name Republican, reaching back to the political tradition that went back to the Renaissance, of the values of a good society in which individuals could pursue their own destinies and fulfill the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And the name caught on, and by the fall of 1854, and as you said, by 1856, the Republicans were organized and in business as a national party.
Mm. After the war, and for a long time, and I guess basically until Woodrow Wilson, the Republicans really dominated American politics.
Right? Well, yes, to a degree. They dominated from the end of the Civil War until the mid-1890s. They elected most of the presidents, with the exception of Grover Cleveland, but actually, parties were pretty evenly balanced through the late 19th century. The Democrats usually controlled the House, the Republicans the Senate, and there was a series of very close presidential elections. Then in the 1890s, there was an economic depression known as the Panic of 1893, and that lasted beyond 1893 for 4 years. And in that time of economic gloom, the Republicans won a sweeping victory in Congress in 1894. They picked up 113 seats. In this fall, if the Democrats were to gain 20 seats or the Republicans were to gain 20 seats, we'd be talking about a political revolution. Well, think of that, five times that many and more being shifted. That made the Republicans the majority party outside the South, which they remained until the Great Depression of the early 1930s. And except for Woodrow Wilson, they remained the majority party, as I say, through McKinley, Roosevelt, Taft, and then Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover.
Mm-hmm. And 1901, the president, William McKinley, was assassinated. The vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, a man that probably nobody ever thought would become president, became president, and then led a period where there was a great deal of Republican progressivism, and probably helped to establish him as being one of the most significant, influential Republicans ever to be president, and a fascinating figure, and someone who I think perhaps in fairly recent years we've been hearing more and more as a result of work of a number of good historians who have been writing about Theodore Roosevelt. Let's talk about him.
Well, yes, Roosevelt was placed in the vice presidency to get him out of the state of New York, where he was the governor, and he was too much of a reformist for the party hierarchy, so they, in the phrase, kicked him upstairs into the solitary quiet of the vice presidency, thinking that, of course, McKinley would serve out his second term and Roosevelt would remain, obscure. But as Mark Hanna, the senator from Ohio, said when Roosevelt was nominated, "Don't any of you fools know that there's only one life between this madman and the White House?" And so it proved in September when McKinley was assassinated of 1901, when McKinley was assassinated and Roosevelt became president. Roosevelt said at the time, "It is a dreadful thing to come to the presidency in this way, but it would be a far worse thing to be morbid about it." And he plunged into running the country. Now, he believed that the United States faced the realistic possibility of a social revolution, that socialism and that class warfare could occur unless moderate reforms were made. And so he advocated for Republicans regulating corporations, doing something along the lines of what was known as social justice, that is, minimum wage for women, old age insurance, even health insurance, and when he ran in 1912. And he said this was necessary. If we don't have cautious, moderate, conservative reform, we'll have more sweeping reform. Well, the Republican Party simply looked at that issue. Some people supported Roosevelt, but a majority of the party decided that that was not the way they wanted to go, that they preferred to keep the government out of regulating business and promoting social justice in that way. And so when Roosevelt turned on his old friend William Howard Taft in 1912 and ran for the Republican nomination, the Republican establishment said, "We're not going to go for Roosevelt." He was defeated and went off and ran his own third party, the Progressive Party.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with Lewis Gould. He is Professor Emeritus of American History at University of Texas, Austin, has written a lot about political history, and is the author of a new book that looks at the history of the Republican Party. The title is Grand Old Party, and it's published by Random House, one of two new books that Random House has out now. One is a history of the Republicans, the other is a history of the Democrats. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the tectonic kind of shifts that happened in American politics, and I think, was the move of African-Americans from the Republicans to the Democrats. And still today, it is the most, for the Democrats, I think it is their most reliable constituency, given the fact that the Republicans began, really it was slavery that made that party, and the first successful Republican at the presidency was Abraham Lincoln. And how is it that the Republicans managed to lose the allegiance of African Americans?
Well, it's the result of a long historical process, which began around the turn of the century and continued during the First World War, when blacks left the South and moved north into the the big cities of the North, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York. Historians call this the Great Migration. And as blacks established themselves in the Midwest and in the Northeast, they obviously found it easier to vote because they were not barred from voting as they were in the South. And they began to make their presence felt by the 1920s and 1930s in local and state and national elections. When the New Deal came in the early 30s and dealt with the problems of the Depression and dispensing relief for the unemployed, and of course blacks disproportionately suffered as of the effects of the Depression because of their difficult economic status. When the New Deal applied its relief programs, they applied them generally in a non-discriminatory way. It doesn't mean they were overtly pro-black at that time, but just to even be even-handed was something that represented a step forward. So blacks began to move toward the Democratic Party. The work of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was sympathetic to black aspirations, helped as well, and also simple political calculations that the Democratic Party seemed to be more sympathetic and more in power than the Republicans began the transition of blacks into the Democratic Party. And as they became more of a force, they legitimately said, hey, we want policies that speak to our needs, and there arose a generation of both white and black politicians in the North who said the Democratic Party can't remain the party of segregation and states' rights. As Hubert Humphrey said in 1948, we have to move, I'm paraphrasing now, we have to move out of the darkness of states' rights into the sunshine of human rights. So throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, blacks begin to move toward the Democrats. Now, the Republicans don't let this happen without a fight. They have success in the 40s, and Eisenhower has success in the 50s. But gradually, Democratic allegiance predominates. And as that happens, the Republicans begin to say, well, we can never outbid the Democrats for black votes. And as Barry Goldwater put it, we should go hunting where the ducks are, which means we should start looking at white voters in the South who are dissatisfied with the Democrats because of race, because of economics, and other concerns, and we should follow a strategy that maximizes our chance to get votes in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and so forth. And as that happens with Goldwater and with Nixon and Ronald Reagan, this tends to move whites into the Republican Party in the South and blacks into the Democratic Party, to the point that you now have a situation where the Democratic candidate this fall or next fall will likely, you know, get somewhere upwards of 90% of the black vote, and the Republican George Bush would be lucky to get 7, 8, or 9% at the most, and that would be a very good showing.
Yeah, it's interesting that it seems fairly likely that also the nominee of the Democratic Party will be a Northeasterner. The last two Democratic presidents were Southerners, but one finds it difficult to imagine a time when maybe that's not that it couldn't ever happen again, but that maybe also reflects the kind of shift that we've seen in where the Democratic strength lies, and this very deliberate strategy, as you say, that began with Goldwater and then continued through Nixon and Reagan by Republicans to make inroads into the South. It was something that indeed for them, for the Republican Party, proved very successful.
Well, to have the Democrats be strong in New England would have astounded Republicans at the end of the 19th century because, Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire were, as they say, rock-ribbed Republican states. In fact, the only two states that went for Alf Landon in 1936 were Maine and Vermont. And it used to be said, you know, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. And then a wag said that after 1936, it was as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. So we've seen a political revolution in the usual way we look at electoral alignments in this country. And it'll be fascinating to see in 2004 whether shifts continue or the alignments of 2000 remain in place.
Let's talk with the caller. We have someone here in Champaign County on our line one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I regard this is a heretical sort of line of argument, but so I don't want to dwell on it too long. But the Republicans, even in the days of Lincoln, were divided. The radical Republicans and the more conservative Republicans, and Lincoln actually fell in that latter category to a large extent. There's a book called Forced into Glory that's quite controversial, but I think it's exceedingly well documented, that says that, you know, Lincoln was pushed into it by the exigencies of the time of being seen as a great liberator. So I see that as sort of a birth myth that is needs reexamination, and I think it sort of explains why the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, you know, colluded to betray Reconstruction, basically, because they were faction sympathetic, and that led to eventually somebody needing to represent the constituencies that were betrayed at that time, mainly African Americans, but actually others as well, seems to me.
Well, Lincoln is still very contested historical ground, his historical reputation and his impact. And there are black Americans who don't regard him as a great emancipator and see him as a person who was governed by political expedience. And in many ways, that, I think, is part of the argument that your caller is advancing. We have to remember, I would just say, that American society in the 1860s was dominated by racial attitudes that today would simply be regarded as abhorrent. But at the time, they were very prevalent. There were anti-black cartoons in newspapers, anti-black stereotypes. Racism of the most striking sort was the common coin of what people talked about. So the issue is not whether there was some sort of better option out there than what the Republicans and Lincoln were offering, flawed and as incomplete as it was, but whether along the spectrum of American politics in that time, this was the best advancement toward human rights that was available. I generally tend to see it that way. I'm a great admirer of Abraham Lincoln and think he was a terrific politician, but the views that your caller expressed are widely held in certain aspects of the historical community, and show that even a revered figure like Lincoln, when you get into the nuts and bolts of his time, that there are still contested ground there.
Well, yeah, he did enjoy a good darky joke. It's quite said that was one of his most favorite early joking. I mean, he did change somewhat because you couldn't make those anymore. But about the tenor of the times, there were people that were making counter-arguments. There were the radical Republicans. There were people that were abolitionists. So, I mean, you can
say... Yeah, but they were a very much beleaguered minority, and
yeah.
even Stevens and Sumner. But I would point to you the remark of Frederick Douglass, who said that Lincoln was the only politician he encountered who treated him as a human being and not as a figure bound by the race issue. But we can, we could argue about this all morning.
You can find other Douglass quotes that may indicate that might have been something that he said at a political moment, maybe in a eulogy or something. But
I mean, as I say, we can go round and round on that.
I would like to turn towards the disputed election. How much time do you spend on the turn of the century election? I guess it was Tilton Harrison?
Hilton Hayes,
Rutherford Hayes, yeah. Because that a lot of at the time of the Florida imbroglio, a lot of people were saying, this was actually what impasse in the Electoral College. There were like 55 votes or something like that, and it was eventually basically just bargained for, I understand, and Tilton, who was the actual winner of the election, if you will, was.
That again, there's a lot of complications to that, and in the election of 1876, Tilden got a majority of the counted popular vote, but there were also blacks who were disenfranchised by extra legal means in the South as well, who simply could not get to the vote. We don't know what an honest count would have produced as far as Tilden and Hayes were concerned, but on election night, when the votes came in, or election the next couple of days, Hayes had 165 electoral votes, Tilton had 184, and you needed 185 to be elected president. There were three states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, where there were disputed results, and those 20 votes would either make Hayes president or Tilden president. both states sent different groups of electors to Washington to say, we are the electoral vote of these states, and it was up to Congress to count the votes. The House was Democratic, the Senate was Republican, so there was a stalemate, and people worried that if they didn't get the issue resolved, there might not even be a president on March 4th, 1877. In those days, presidents took office in March. So they established an electoral commission to decide the issue, which eventually voted 8-7 along party lines to make Hayes the president. The larger implications of what's known as the Compromise of 1877 is that there was a kind of sectional bargain. The South said, we'll accept Hayes as president. The North said, we'll stop trying to push Reconstruction, and we won't take the troops out of the South, but we'll take the troops out of politics, and we won't interfere in the running of what would then be Democratic governments, big D Democratic governments in the South. By that time, 12 years after the war, the country was, for the racial reasons we just discussed, tired of Reconstruction, believed that it was impossible to make multiracial societies work in the South, and essentially white America washed its hands of Reconstruction and turned away from civil rights for more than 75 years. And that's what made the election of 1876 and the Compromise of 1877 so crucial. In that, it wasn't like Florida in 2000 in quite the same way, but many of the same procedural issues and questions arose in both elections.
We're moving into our last half hour. I want to encourage, if there are other people who are listening and would like to call in and be a part of the program, you can do that. 333-9455, also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Lewis Gould. He's Professor Emeritus of American History at University of Texas at Austin and author of a newly published history of the Republican Party titled Grand Old Party, and it's published by Random House. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's sort of the conventional wisdom that the election of Franklin Roosevelt and the long period of Democrat dominance that followed that was made possible by the Republicans' ineptitude when it came to doing anything about the Depression, and that was why it is that that Roosevelt beat Hoover in 32. Do you think that, in fact, though, that the conventional wisdom there is shortchanging Herbert Hoover?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that if you think that Hoover essentially did nothing to fight the Depression, that's an erroneous interpretation. There were many people who advised him to let the economy bottom out and let the keep the government out, and then things would turn around. But he didn't believe that in that kind of passive role, and he did more as president to fight a depression than any president before him had done. The tragedy for Hoover was that what he did, while commendable and directed in the right way, or in the right sense of trying to deal with the problem, simply wasn't enough to accomplish what he was trying to do. The other problem that he had was one of personality, and that's so often central in politics. Hoover adopted a kind of, well, we'll get through this if we all take our medicine and act tough. I know it'll be hard for you, but you just have to bear with me and stay the course, and we'll be all right. And as the Depression kept getting worse, Americans believed that the president was not simply being tough-minded, but was insensitive and didn't care about their concerns. That probably was unfair, but Hoover was not able to project the kind of optimism and confidence that came naturally to Franklin Roosevelt. And so to the degree that he became detached from the lives of other Americans and seemed to be aloof and unconcerned, he suffered politically. His party also really didn't have an answer that would spark optimism of government spending or creating new programs, doing things to provide relief that Franklin Roosevelt tried in the mid-30s.
Mm. And after that, then it would be 20 years, right? There were 20 years there between Republican presidents from Hoover to Eisenhower.
Yes.
Right. And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Dwight Eisenhower, also because it seems in recent years there has been something of a reassessment, and I think that historians have said, well, that Eisenhower as a president had been underappreciated and underrated.
Yes, Eisenhower's stock has been rising since he left the White House in 1960. If you had bought, metaphorically speaking, Eisenhower stock in the mid-60s and held it, you'd be doing very well now, because historians, and especially a political scientist named Fred Greenstein at Princeton, have argued that Eisenhower was what he calls a hidden hand president, that he was very clever and astute in how he did things behind the scenes, and that he had a certain genial public persona and was very tough-minded and very effective in private, and that Eisenhower generally got done what he wanted to get done because he knew how to use people and was able to discard the people that weren't helping him and to encourage others. And so Eisenhower's reputation as a president who had 8 years of peace and relative prosperity in the 1950s and kept us out of war and managed foreign policy effectively, that has seen his stock rise to the point where Eisenhower stands in a much higher credit with historians than would have seemed possible when I started graduate school in 1961.
Yeah. One of the things that certainly happened since then within the Republican Party is the rise of the conservative wing, and the fact that the party has become increasingly conservative, certainly after Eisenhower. In fact, in some respects, if you look at where the party is today, Nixon even starts to look kind of liberal. What happened within the party? Why did that happen? That beginning with Goldwater, who was unsuccessful, and then later moving on to Reagan, who was successful, that the more conservative elements within the party, particularly those who are we would call social conservatives, became so important and so powerful, to the point now that I know that I'm sure some people would argue that the party itself has moved significantly to the right.
Well, the Republican Party is a very open political organization. That is, if you get enough Republicans who think the way you do to go to precinct meetings, county caucuses, state conventions, you can have your voice heard at all levels of the party. And what happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s is that conservatives, energized after the Second World War by anti-communism, economic conservatism, and social issues, did the hard work of politics. They went to the meetings, they sat through four-hour sessions where the resolutions were adopted at the end, and they essentially, when I say took over, I mean became the party machinery. And then they insisted, as leaders of the party, that having their views represented. In the 30s and 40s, Republican leaders had said, look, we've got to nominate moderate figures like Wendell Willkie and Thomas E. Dewey and Dwight Eisenhower to appeal to the broad mass of Americans, and then we can have conservative policies when we get in power. Well, it was a reasonable strategy, but Willkie, Dewey didn't win, and when Eisenhower came in and advocated what he called modern republicanism, which would have accepted some basic parts of the New Deal, Republicans didn't win at the state and local levels. They lost seats in Congress in the 1950s, and the Democrats gained control for 40 years. So conservative Republicans said, look, this Me Too policy where you say, the Democrats say I'm for the New Deal, and Republicans say, Me Too, but I'll run it better, or we'll be more fiscally conservative, but essentially we accept the New Deal. This simply hadn't paid off at the ballot box, and so they said, let's try real republicanism. Let's stand for conservative values. If it means we have to lose, as we do in 1964, eventually our point of view will prevail. And they were vindicated in that sense by Ronald Reagan in 1980. Nixon is a kind of transitional figure who was never as conservative as conservatives thought he should be. And in fact, there are some historians who call Nixon the last liberal president, because he did so much for the environment and on social economic policies, though he was, a very conservative man in his own personality and political views. But generally, it was simply, it wasn't some secret thing. The Republicans who thought the way conservative Republicans did simply put in the time and effort to become dominant within the party. Mm. And that's still the key to their success, is that, you know, they are truly committed to the political ideals they espouse and put themselves into the process in ways that their opponents are not often eager to do.
We have a caller here in Centralia. Let us talk with them next on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Is the, historically speaking, is this really divisive, corrosive kind of animosity that goes on between the Republicans and Democrats right now in the Congress? Is this a new low for the Congress, or is this something that's happened in the past historically and we're focusing on it right now because that's what's in front of us at the moment?
Well, the partisanship in the late 19th century was pretty intense, and the Republicans and Democrats hurled some pretty tough epithets at each other, and partisanship was very intense. Most people were partisans, either Republicans or Democrats. There were virtually no independents in the late 19th century. The ideal of sort of nonpartisanship and civility was something that existed in the first, say, 5, 6, 7 decades of the 20th century, but we are now back in a very partisan episode. And I think most political historians would say that partisanship is what makes the democratic system go. The drawback of that is if you get to the point where you start believing that your opponents are not simply, as I say in the book, a necessary evil, but evil and traitorous, then you're into ground where there's not a sort of democratic consensus on fundamental values, and you might move, as in reviewing my book, The Economist said, we're moving toward European-style ideological politics. That may be where we're headed. But there are difficulties with that that haven't existed in American history if we get there, and maybe we're already there, that at least some people should, you know, give some thought to.
Now, I heard Patrick Buchanan, liberal speaker on, I think it was the McLaughlin Report on Sunday, say that he thought the Republicans would win the election in 2004, and then all the chickens would come home to roost, and there would be a wipeout in 2006. So,
well, it could be. I mean, he's a political veteran, but he's also called it wrong before. I do think that if we get through this election, however it turns out, the next president is going to face not just a few chickens, but a whole flock. There are issues of the budget deficit, entitlements, foreign policy. And at some point, the nation is going to face hard choices that we've sort of kicked down the road, but it looks like we're running out of road and the choices are still there.
It seems like that both sides want to use, they'd like to use those, the real problems for wedge issues instead. And we'll beat them over the head with this, but we won't solve it, we'll just beat them over the head with it. Well, eventually it's going to come down on all our heads, I'm afraid.
Well, I must say I tend to think you've got a good point about that, and it's a sort of a systemic problem of the way continuous campaigning and modern politics is operating, and how we get out of it. Well, happily, I don't have to decide that at 11:45 this morning, but it's going to be an issue we'll face.
Okay, well, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
Interesting subject. Thank you.
We have now about 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Lewis Gould. He's an emeritus professor in American history at University of Texas at Austin, author of a newly published History of the Republican Party. Grand Old Party is the title, published by Random House. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you want to call, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that over time that people of both parties have said pretty nasty things about the other. Do you think that it's the case, I get the impression that you do think it's the case, that though the Republicans have tended to do that more than have the Democrats?
Well, I wouldn't want to say that, but I think the formative experience of the Civil War is salient here. The Republicans believed, and I think correctly, that they were fighting to preserve the Union and the the American experiment. There were many Democrats who shared that opinion and who supported the war, but there was also a significant number of Democrats who wanted a negotiated peace with the South, who wanted to preserve slavery, and who flirted or in some ways colluded with the South in ways that could have appeared at the time traitorous. The Republicans concluded that the Democratic Party in its very nature was less patriotic, less American, less committed to the Union than Republicans were. And that sense that the Democrats are not fully as patriotic as Republicans and other Americans has continued through the party's history, and there are echoes of it that appear in recent years and, as I say, throughout American history. It is a powerful political weapon, but there are dangers if you label sort of half the population as less American than the other half, and how we resolve that as a democratic society is a question we're going to face.
We have another caller here in Belgium by Danville, line four. Hello.
Hello. Your previous caller talked about the loggerheads that the two parties seem to have. And I have a real question. In that during the Clinton administration, all the Republicans could do was just baffle everything the Democrats tried to do, especially in judges and stuff. And now Bush suggests these judges, and they're getting the same treatment, and they're crying foul. Now, how could they possibly do that in any good sense?
Well, I would say that consistency in politics is something you don't need to really look for as a major value. Both parties tend to adopt the position that serves their interest in terms of even constitutional interpretation or political philosophy. And so it really does depend on what your end is that you want to achieve, and then you select the means or the argument that will get you there. It isn't that they're hypocrites about this, though there is some of that in both parties, but it's just that politics and the American system puts a premium on victory and not so much on philosophical consistency. If we made philosophical consistency a big virtue, most working politicians would be out of a job by this afternoon.
That's true, because they've pushed things off, just like you said, so many times. They said, we're just going to fight about it and say no, when it's obvious something has to be done.
Well, but in justice to the politicians, I mean, they reflect a society that I think that is reluctant to also itself to face the choices. I mean, I've read politicians where they say, every one of my constituents wants more projects and lower taxes at the same time. Now, you can't have it both ways. And a politician who comes and says, well, look, it's time to be hard-nosed and make the tough choices, he or she may get applause, but then when you say, well, here are the tough choices, people tend to head for the exits and say, well, there's somebody else that's more appealing on the, you know, will make us happier. So politicians somewhat reflect our own divided view of responsibility and the choices we face.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. I want to ask you one of the same questions I asked of Jules Whitcover in the last hour, and that is whether you thought that there was any reasonable possibility that in the near future we would see a third party make a significant challenge to the dominance of the Democrats and the Republicans.
Well, I think the Green Party is trying, but it's still in the baby steps situation. One has to be cautious about this because you have to assume some sort of social cataclysm that would break up the stranglehold that the Democrats and Republicans have on the way politics works in the United States. But it could happen if you had an economic upheaval, the unthinkable of, you know, a repetition of September 11th, some sort of systemic social disaster where it was clear that the political process had failed to some degree or another, and Americans said, look, we simply, you know, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party is not a viable way we want to live together anymore. One hopes that that doesn't happen because, the cure might be worse than the disease in terms of the conditions that it would that such a change would grow out of. But one can also see the centrifugal tendencies in American society. This is a big country, and running it effectively may not be as easy as it seemed to be, say, 50 or 60 years ago. So I think, well, I'd put it, say, 60-40, we'd stay pretty much the way we are, but that 40% is perhaps higher than I might have placed it 10 or 15 years ago.
Hmm. Now, I guess one wonders, because my impression is you get a lot of people talking about how ideological the parties have become. Interestingly enough, it wasn't all that long ago that a lot of people were saying, oh, there's no difference between the two of them. Just 4 years ago, people were saying that. And now it does indeed seem that they're farther apart. Politics is more partisan than it has been. That there seems that there's this opportunity of people who would locate themselves somewhere in the middle of the political spectrum, who would say that on a variety of issues that the two parties were drawing closer to the ends of the continuum, and maybe that there might be some room for somebody to go in there and kind of pick issues and put together a kind of a position that would be more centrist, and that might be an opportunity to pick up some voters.
Well, I think one of the major parties would have to go into sort of a terminal decay like the Whigs. Because I think as long as there are two viable parties, the winner-take-all aspect of American politics makes it really hard for a third party to succeed. But if the Democratic Party fulfilled the title of Zell Miller's book, you know, Is a National Party No More, I think that's overdone. But if that happened and the Democrats, you know, really collapsed, then there would need to be, or people might see a need for an alternative to the Republicans. I doubt that the Republicans would go into that kind of change, though there are strains now about the Bush spending policies and foreign policy and other issues that are pulling at some of the fault lines within the Republican Party. But I think they're a long way, obviously, from any sort of internal collapse. So I would say as long as the Democrats, you know, remain at least cohesive enough to stay together every 4 years, the chances of a third party are marginal.
Well, there we must leave it, because we're here at the end of the time. Again, if you'd like to read about the history of the Republican Party, you can look for the book we've mentioned, Grand Old Party, by our guest Lewis Gould, and also the book from the first hour, if you want to read about the Democrats, by Jules Whitcover. That's Party of the People. They're both published by Random House. Our guest this hour, Lewis Gould, is Emeritus Professor of American History, University of Texas at Austin. And Professor Gould, thanks very much.
Thank you.